I'm Sandeep Kaushik. I'm a consultant to the campaign.
I'm Viet Shelton, and I'm the campaign manager.
Okay. First of all, you guys were involved in the last campaign. I'm just curious how things are different this time around. What are the main differences?
I would just start off, I'd say the last campaign was different in that we had a very hotly contested primary with multiple candidates in it. So the race really ramped up early. The primary results were incredibly important, and obviously it was Susan and John Koster that went through. We knew who the Republican candidate was going to be in that race very early because Koster was clearly a candidate, but on the Democratic side it was very, very hotly contested. This is almost the reverse of that, where you've got now Susan's the incumbent Democrat who holds a seat, and we had a primary that turned out to be very, very close and contested on the Republican side, which with Pedro Solis barely emerging to be the Republican candidate. So that's very different. Viet, anything else?
No, I think that's the most dramatic thing. I think the other thing from 2 years ago was you had two candidates who weren't members of Congress running to be elected
that's
for
right.
the first time to the
that's
seat.
Right.
And now this time around you very much have the Congresswoman with a record. And so it's a record she's talking about, and it's a record that is honestly a focus of the campaign and in the race in general.
Running, by the way, against a candidate with no experience in elective office.
Which your candidate was last time around.
Yeah, but she had significant experience that she brought. She had been a candidate, in fact, before for serious office, so she had a lot of time delving into issues. She sort of brought that to the table in the last race. But yeah, she had not held elected office before, but as Viet says, we've now had 2 years with Susan in office, and she's demonstrated her ability to get things done, even in the context of a pretty dysfunctional political scene in the nation's capital.
Okay. Just going back to that race, one of the memorable things about that race was the ad that you ran in which her name was repeatedly mentioned over and over and over again. Was that your idea? And did it accomplish what you hoped it would?
That was an ad that was put together by our media consulting firm, Cully Hall, who happened to be actually housed next door over here. But it's Susan Del Bene, of course, right? We can still all remember that tagline. That was an ad that they put together. One of the challenges you have when you're running as a challenger, someone who's not held office, is introducing yourself to voters, to building up what we call name ID. And that was an ad that was really intended to connect voters with Susan and make sure that they understood that she was the Democratic candidate in that race that they ought to be supporting. And so the repetition of that line and her name, I thought, was very effective in helping us to do that. With a TV ad, you have 30 seconds to make your pitch, and that's not a lot of time. And so the fact that we were able to use that to kind of burn her name in with a lot of the voters really was effective. Turned out to be effective.
We're not going to see an ad like that this time around, are we?
There are no plans at the moment.
Yeah.
No.
Well,
I mean,
we
have
TV ads up, and they're not.
They're not like that.
Yeah, they're not. Susan Del Bene, of course.
Well, they're repetitive, I guess.
So one of the things that Pedro Selly says is that he doesn't think that she does have high name recognition at this point. Having served 2 years, he says there's still, according to his research, 20% of voters don't know who she is.
Well, I actually think the opposite is true. His performance in the primary was exceedingly weak. He barely made it through, and I think he is all but unknown. I don't think that he's demonstrated much since the primary in terms of defining himself in a way that's actually attractive to first district voters. It's a swing district. It's a moderate district. It's a diverse district. Running all the way to the Canadian border from the Seattle suburbs. Susan's a great fit for that district. She's a moderate Democrat who's sort of not interested in sort of partisan game playing. She's interested in policy and working on the issues she cares about, whether it's privacy issues, whether it was putting together the farm bill in a way that actually helped farmers in the district. So she does have I think she is well known around the district. I think, you know, she played a significant role in responding when we had the bridge collapse, when we had the tragedy in Oso. So she is known around the district, and she's liked around the district, and she's known for being somebody who gets things done around the district.
Did you just call, did you call Delbene a moderate Democrat? Is that how she's portraying herself? I always thought she called herself a progressive Democrat.
I don't know whether, I don't want to sort of label her, but I think it's a moderate district. I would use the moderate in the way as a synonym for pragmatic, for somebody who works for solutions, who's willing to work across the aisle to get stuff done. You know, she's operating in a Congress that currently is controlled by the Republican Party, and yet she was able to have significant influence on the farm bill. I mean, yet, you know, there's a whole series of different things where she's brought that kind of pragmatic streak and that solutions-focused streak to bear in an environment where, as we all know in D.C., that kind of it's an environment now that's sort of tarred by this kind of toxic hyper-partisanship and sort of cheap political point scoring, and she's not interested in any of that kind of stuff. So I would call her, so that's what I mean, I think, when I say that moderate. I mean, you could just easily call her kind of pragmatic progressive. Obviously, when you look at her views on issues, standing up for a woman's right to choose, or
Social Security,
yeah, making sure we put money into resources for, you know, food stamps for lower income families, things like that. Those are progressive views, but she has a pragmatic approach to it.
Yeah, I mean, I think pragmatic and solutions oriented is a pretty accurate way to describe her approach at lawmaking. Because when you look at her work on the House Agriculture Committee, she's operating in a Republican led Congress, or in the House side anyway, and she was able to insert provisions that she authored and drafted into what was a bipartisan farm bill, but it had to leave a Republican majority House at the end of the day. And then when you look at her work on the Judiciary Committee in terms of privacy and civil liberties and the reaction to the NSA spying, it was her working across the aisle with traditionally very conservative Republicans, whether it's Justin Amash or George Sensenbrenner, who was basically the father of the Patriot Act in 2002. Those are instances of it was less about partisan ideology and more about approaching the issue to see if there was a way to get to a solution on it.
How much do you worry that in this environment where people are really mad at Congress and having gone through the shutdown and all the various, you know, dysfunctions that are happening in D.C., that everyone who is an incumbent just gets tarred as, you know, part of the problem, let's kick the bums out?
I think it's a things like that are a concern. I don't think there's any dispute that Congress is not held in high esteem these days. But I would point out that this is, again, a Republican-controlled Congress, and when you dig down with voters and you ask them why they think things aren't working in Congress as well as they should be, I think there's a pretty significant understanding among a lot of voters that it's the extremism of much of the Republican caucus that blocks any efforts to move forward on key pieces of legislation. For instance, let's talk about immigration. The Senate, on a bipartisan basis, passed a really important comprehensive immigration reform bill that will actually move us forward on fixing what everyone acknowledges is our broken immigration system. Susan is a strong supporter of that legislation. There's probably enough votes to pass that in Congress, but the Republicans' leadership in Congress is refusing to allow that to come forward and pass, and therefore we're left in this unfortunate status quo situation with the immigration system working. That's a classic example of, yes, that's dysfunction, but why is there dysfunction? It's because there's certain, what I would call extreme elements who, you know, the tail is wagging the dog in the Republican caucus in a lot of ways in terms of why things don't move forward. So that is something that I think a lot of voters understand. And there's also, I think, our campaign is in a good position because Susan does have a track record of very concrete things she's been able to accomplish despite all of that hyper-partisanship. And I think voters have seen that, whether it's securing money to help replace the bridge when the bridge collapsed on I-5, or getting provisions in the farm bill that were really, really important, helping farmers. Yeah. Dairy farmers in the district. So we have a story to tell about her actions and her performance and what she's done over the last 2 years that also helped sort of differentiate and kind of take us out of the context of that sort of the larger negative perceptions of what's going on in D.C.
What does that look like concretely? I mean, when a freshman member of Congress goes to D.C. and says, "I'm going to be bipartisan," what does that mean? Does that mean taking Republicans out to lunch? Does that mean, like, literally walking down the hall? I mean, what do you do to do that?
I'd probably say it is, or at least in the case of Susan, it's been finding colleagues of, I think, like interests in terms of a few policy areas, whether it's the farm bill or privacy issues, on her respective committees. They're legislators and lawmakers that you're sitting with and working with on a regular basis, and it's finding places where there are moments of agreement on certain issue areas and sitting down and working on the bills that they can find some agreement on that actually is beneficial to their communities and their constituents back in their home districts and also moves the ball forward on the issue.
What does your polling show in terms of what the big issues for First District voters are? Are they social issues or are they more economic jobs?
I think voters are concerned about the economy is obviously, has been front and center for the last few years. It continues to be. We are now finally in a position where we're starting to feel the economic recovery and people are a little more optimistic about what the future looks like. And so they're interested in moving forward now on a range of things that while the economy was tougher, they might have wanted to kind of hunker down a little bit for. So, Susan is a strong advocate, for instance, for raising the federal minimum wage to $10.10 as President Obama has proposed. You can look at all the developments that are going on in cities around the country. You know, Seattle, obviously, we just passed a $15 minimum wage that's going to be implemented, but look at Los Angeles or Chicago or San Francisco. All of these cities are working on their own minimum wage ordinances. This is a major issue developing around the country. It's time for the federal government to take action on it. Susan's been advocating for that, so I think those are the sorts of issues that those kind of pocketbook issues are issues they care about. And they do. Choice, for instance, is an issue that is always important to voters. Washington State is a strong pro-choice state. Women in the state, and has been for decades. And again, candidates like Pedro Solis are—they're on the wrong side of history on
marriage equality,
on marriage equality,
on choice, and that it does matter to the voters. That those sorts of social issues also were indicative of the candidates they're deciding on and where I think they perceive their values are.
That's right. It's not only that the issues are important in and of themselves, but they are in some sense a proxy for a larger worldview, how somebody thinks about the world. And so as a voter, when you look and say, oh, that guy's anti-choice, that guy's saying gay marriage is like polygamy, that guy's supporting Mike Huckabee, you say, well, you know, he doesn't think about the world the same way I do. He doesn't have the same set of values as Viet is saying. And so I think that's right. Those issues have a significance beyond just the issues themselves. But I think they tell voters something something bigger about what the candidate, how the candidate thinks and what they believe.
Is there any way that they play out concretely, though, in Congress? I mean, what would he be voting on? What kind of legislation would he be having to make choices on?
Sure.
Regarding those sorts of social issues.
One of the first bills that the House Judiciary Committee voted on in January of 2014 was an anti-choice bill, H.R. 7, one of the first bills, right out of the gate. And it was then brought onto the House floor.
What was the bill?
So it was a bill to, I think, continue limiting access. It was an attempt to limit women's access to reproductive health services and insurance coverage. Is what it did in general terms. And it was one of the first bills of 2014, right after all the fights over the budget and the shutdown, and it was supposed to be a new year, and let's see what happened, and right out of the gates. First bill they came up with was H.R. 7, and it was one of the first bills in January that they brought onto the House floor as well. So when it comes to issues of choice, women's reproductive health, or in the case of this current Congress, a lack of a willingness to move forward on things like EDNA legislation, ending discrimination in the workplace because of your sexual orientation. These are real things that are being considered by this Congress. And so to say that you're going to run on a platform that doesn't discuss those issues, I think is woefully ignorant of what you're going to do in Congress then, yeah, as a lawmaker.
You may not want to discuss them, but you're going to vote on them when you get to Congress, right? I mean, we're in a situation where, as everyone knows, there's the control of the U.S. Senate hangs in the balance. It's possible that Republicans could grab control of the U.S. Senate at the end of this election. They have control of the House. So if you're sending somebody like Pedro Solis to Congress, and they're going to have opportunity to start voting on some of these bills, it might actually start moving in a significant way. If Republicans get control of the other body, those are real issues. Those are live issues, and so I don't think he gets a pass. I don't think he gets to dodge
right.
his views on that stuff. It's voters think it's important, and they're right to think it's important because it is important.
I mean,
that's part of the job.
Yeah, no, I mean, if the Senate does flip, you got U.S. senators right now that are proposing constitutional ban or constitutional amendments to uphold state bans on same-sex marriage. So. You flip the Senate, you're certainly going to have that get brought up.
I asked the congresswoman this last night. So she's one of the wealthiest members of Congress. She spent $4.5 million of her own money in her first two elections. And yet she talks about the need to get money out of politics. How do you convince voters that you're serious about that when, in fact, she use so much of her own money to self-fund her campaigns? And, you could argue that she made it into Congress based on her wealth. So how do you make that case that you're serious about needing to get money out of politics?
Well, I think what she has said is that we need to have a comprehensive solution on campaign finance reform, something that helps us ensure that there's a level playing field across the board and that we're being transparent about where money is coming from, and that we're making sure that certain constituencies don't get undue or excessive influence over the political and decision-making process. So, Susan ran for Congress in 2010 and spent some of her own money and lost. So this idea that you can just sort of come in and spend some money because you have some and win in Congress just isn't true. Most self-funding candidates lose their elections, candidates who significantly self-fund. So when she came
As
back
you
in...
pointed out a few times in 2012.
Yeah, right. So when Susan came back in 2012, she had a message and she had a case to make about why she would be a good representative for that district in Congress, and that's why she won that election. You can spend, what was it, the governor's race in California where, I'm forgetting her name, but...
the eBay executive.
The EBAC. She spent $150 million of her own money running for governor of California and lost. She wasn't even close. because she was the I mean, she was a terrible fit for the state and not the greatest candidate in the world. And so, you know, does money help in political races? Absolutely, it does. But the point is, I think Susan won because she had a message and she had a track record in the private sector and a set of positions on issues that resonated with voters in 2012. So I think she has absolute credibility to come in and say we need to make fixes to our campaign finance system. I think most voters again agree with that position too. You know, we should have that kind of transparency. We should be making sure that we're not allowing the system to kind of run out of control.
Is she likely to put any of her own money into this race? She hasn't yet.
I don't think she has plans to do so at this point, but I don't think there's any kind of definitive decision made. Obviously, we're now into October. We're not that far away from the end of the campaign. She has not put any of her money into the race so far. Doesn't have plans to do so at this point.
So you guys have talked about this new campaign team that Pedro Siles has. These are the guys who...
I have talked about it a few times.
These are the guys who helped Eric Cantor lose his job.
To David Bratt,
candidate David Bratt, who's a Tea Party guy. And Pedro says that the reason he brought them in is because they know how to win elections with very little money.
I think, right, they were brought in because Pedro did terribly. He barely made it out of the primary, and I think he's been running scared ever since that he's not connecting with the Republican base. So he brought in these Tea Party but young men or guys, these Tea Party guys, to help, shore up his right wing bona fides. And that's the rhetoric that comes out of their campaign these days is, I think, sort of boilerplate Tea Party.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like he hired him to bring in some folks to help strengthen his Tea Party credentials. And if you look at the stuff that they've been producing and putting out of their campaign so far, it's very, very Tea Party-ish, to the point where they're literally copying and pasting policy positions from their old Tea Party bosses and putting them on Pedro's website.
He just did an op-ed in the Bellingham Herald where he seemed to imply that it was wrong to vote to raise the debt ceiling, which my next question to him then would be, so you won't shut down the government? Is that what but that's, again, the sort of extreme conservative right-wing position that you hear sort of repeated in those constituencies all the time, and he's just towing the line on all of that stuff.
You said earlier that the Republican base in this district is very conservative. Are you saying that the Republican Party is very conservative in this district, or that who he's trying to appeal to are very conservative?
No, I think the party is very conservative
in this district.
I mean, I think they're very conservative nationally. I think they've become increasingly conservative everywhere, but in the district, they're certainly, yeah, the Republican base, the Republican Party is very conservative. And, again, I don't think it's a secret or I don't think it's a coincidence that their candidate last time was John Koster, very conservative, very strong social conservative, economic conservative. And their candidate this time is Pedro Solis, again, very, I think he's a genuine, very right-wing social conservative guy. You know, I mean, ever since he's sort of been involved in politics before running, when you look at who he's given money to, the candidates he's supported, you know, there's a picture of him in the Seattle Times at this sort of,
like a pro-life lunch Huckabee.
Yeah, it was sort of Huckabee wanted to shore up the fact that he was the most anti-choice candidate running for president, and there was a fundraiser lunch put together some very conservative pastors. The picture in the Seattle Times is Pedro Solis, you know, and Mike Huckabee standing there together at that event. I think that the other side, the Republican Party, the base over there, is pretty out there, pretty extreme, pretty right wing.
And how big is the Tea Party in the first district?
I don't know. I don't know that.
I don't really know.
I think they're loud. I don't know how big they are, but I think they're loud and they have a lot of influence in those circles.
Well, one last thing, and talking to Salise's campaign managers, you know, they're from out of state. They came from the East Coast, and they expressed a little kind of surprise at the fact that with mail-in voting, you know, election day is kind of a two-week-long affair, three-week-long affair.
Yeah.
As the whole state has gone to mail-in voting, how have your tactics changed in terms of getting your message out?
I'll start. Yeah. So when mail-in voting first really took hold about 6 or 7 years ago or whenever it was, a lot of people voted early. Right, they get their ballots 3 weeks before the election, and maybe a quarter of the electorate would vote that first weekend, and then votes would sort of trickle in over the next few weeks, and then a bunch of people voted at the end. As people have gotten used to mail-in balloting in Washington State, it's actually, interestingly, become more. It's moved back towards being more like a day of, you know, election day kind of voting cycle, where a small number of people vote that first weekend when they get their votes, maybe a little 10% or a little bit less, then votes trickle in. But the vast majority, two-thirds of the votes probably, if not more, come in that last weekend and that Monday and Tuesday of Election Day. So most voters are, especially during the summer, weather's nice, they're outside, they're having a good time, they're going to work, they have their families. They're not paying they're not paying sort of front and center attention to the election. And then when you get to the after Labor Day, interest starts picking up, attention starts picking up. And then when those ballots drop, that's when a lot of voters really start paying attention. They do their homework. They start reading the articles, seeing what the media coverage is, doing some research about the candidates and making decisions about how they vote. And so that three-week period from when ballots arrive in the mailboxes to when to Election Day is really, really important in terms of communication for us. And so that you build your campaign communication plan sort of based on what happens in those 3 weeks and usually maybe, you know, the week beforehand, because that's when voters are really bearing down and kind of cluing into that. So you build it so that again you're making sure you're, because a lot of voters are going to be voting those last few days, that you're communicating with them in particular as they're actually sitting down and kind of thing. Okay, who am I going
to
vote for?
Well, and compared to the old days when we actually went to the polls and we didn't have so much on the internet, are they more likely to procrastinate now and just not pay attention at all? Because I get the sense that people say, oh, I'm going to cram, like last minute, I'll just cram all my research in, because they can do that now, whereas it was harder before.
People are voting later and later, you know, in closer and closer to Election Day. So I think some people do wait. Yeah, you know, I mean, we've seen demographic differences. Younger voters tend to vote really late, you know, so that the you know, older voters will sort of get it done a little earlier and kind of clue in a little earlier and start paying attention. Maybe younger people who have busier lives or...
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. I started off as a field organizer 12 years ago or something, and so back then there was an election day. There were polls. There were folks who sort of just crammed, brought in their voter's guide with them, and they filled out their ballot, and they left the library. And the campaigns were all oriented around that Tuesday, and it was all the activity of where are you going to go, how are you going to get your voters to the polls, and fill out their ballot and drum up attention to do that. And now all of a sudden, it's this three-week scramble of every time you're talking to someone during those 3 weeks, they could potentially hang up the phone and fill out their ballot and mail it in. And so there's that elevated pressure. The other thing that's really different just on a day-to-day campaign activity is that Saturday or Sunday before Election Day is about equally important as that Tuesday, because you're getting folks hopefully at their kitchen table filling out their ballot, and I actually think it's less cramming now, because before it was, I'm waking up on Tuesday, I should bring in the voter pamphlet and figure out what the heck I'm going to do with the library or the community center, versus now, I got the weekend. I got an evening to kind of actually flip through and look at this stuff. And so you're cramming in the sense that you're still voting late in the last few days, But now you're doing it over an evening versus 10 minutes at a community center. And
right.
That's
I mean,
really weird
particularly
shift.
In lower information, you know, lower down the ballot races, lower information with judge races and stuff. Like, used to be, like, you go in there and I don't know who these people are. And, you know, I'm somebody who pays a lot of attention to politics, and I'd see a lot of, you know, these names. And, you know, but now, yeah, you're actually at home. You sit down, you get on your laptop and,
yep.
you know, looks at who did, you know, the Times endorse, who did the Stranger endorse, you know, in city race. You know, so.
I've heard stories of people who fill out their ballot over the course of a few nights because they look at their ballot, see what's on there, and then they start asking around later.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
What about that judge race I never thought
yeah.
about?
Yeah, I get texts from friends who, you know, who aren't involved in politics. You know, you're the politics guy. Tell, you know, what do you know about so-and-so? So, you know.
That's never been an option before
right.
mail-in ballots. Before it was, you're just there. Decide.
Yeah.